Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Author Colin McCann, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you doing?
Good, good, good to talk to you again, Colin. Your new novel, Twist, is great. It's kind of one of those full immersion stories that just transports you off out of life. I think in a way, the less people know about the book, the better going into it. But broadly, it centres around these undersea cables that connect the whole world. And I know this will seem to people like a random conversation now, but it's absolutely fascinating. Tell me about the cables first. Like, physically, what are they? How many of them are there? What do they do? What goes through them?
Well, it's incredible. Well, first of all, you know, our voices are going through them right now. And I'm bouncing down in patterns of light underneath the sea, all the way from New York to Ireland. But unbelievably, 95% of the world's intercontinental information travels under the sea, not just, you know, in the ports and everything, but down in the abyss. In the abyssal zones, as they call them, you know, 6-7 kilometers below the sea, where it's dark. But there are about 450 cables carrying all that information, which isn't really all that much. And sometimes they break, you know, they can break close to shore, or a fishing trawler can rip them up, or they can be sabotaged, or indeed, you can have a huge underwater landslide or an earthquake, and they can disrupt this information, which, by the way, carries $10 trillion worth of deals every single day. So they're pretty important to us.
And physically, you mentioned glass there. At heart, they're not like what we might imagine, huge, big, thick things or anything. At heart, they're a very delicate thing.
No, when I first started researching this, I thought I'd come across these huge tubes, you know, the size of your room and carrying everything. But no, they are the size of a garden hose. And within the garden hose, then, are these tiny fibers, fiber optic cables, which are no bigger than the size of your eyelash. And that is what carries light, which then gets translated, pulses billions of times per second. It's kind of miraculous in a way when you think about it.
Yeah, and, when you put it that way, that what I'm hearing, your voice now, is being transmitted as light through the something the size of a garden hose thousands of miles across under the ocean. It's extraordinary. So the cloud isn't in the sky?
The cloud is not in the sky. I always thought it was, because we kind of think, you know, our voices are going to bounce celestially up into this wonderful cloud, and then it comes back down to Earth and everything. The cloud is actually at the bottom of the sea, where, you know, T.S. Eliot called it, you know, lingering in the chambers of the sea till human voices wake us and we drown.
Yeah. You know? And look, we're kind of becoming more and more aware that there are lots of these cables in our own waters. And then we're seeing, just during the week there, I saw that Taiwan caught a Chinese ship apparently in the act of cutting a subsea cable. And to read the book, it sounds like we're incredibly vulnerable, are we?
We're incredibly, incredibly vulnerable, not just in Ireland, but really all around the world. Now, the internet is self-healing. And what that means is that if one cable gets cut, the information gets routed around to other places. But if two or three cables get cut, especially if they get cut out at deep sea, where it takes about 6 weeks to repair them, a lot of things can be thrown into turmoil. Now, if there were a state actor, which there have been recently, trying to mess with the cables, as the Russians have been in the Baltic Seas, things can get really, really, really hairy. In fact, I have some friends who said to me, I had some marketing campaign going on because the Russians were bringing all sorts of attention to cables, you know, not just in the Baltic Sea, but as we know, off the coast of Donegal, there was some activity, and off the coast of Cork and Kerry. Look, we have to be very conscious of our cables. And Ireland has a great history in terms of the cables since the first transatlantic cables.
And the cable station is still down there in Valencia. It's been repurposed now, but it's still there. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think we have to be aware of this stuff. It's intriguing and it's wonderful, but it's also concerning because yes, we are vulnerable.
Because I think we decide for our sanity not to think too much that these thin threads holding together everything we take for granted.
Right. And that is hardware, and that it's men and women who are behind all this, that people have to go out to sea and they have to literally use a grappling hook to look for a cable that might have been disrupted by some sort of natural event or a flood. It's incredible to think that we depend on people like that.
Yeah, because the fixing of the cables you portray in the book, and I think people imagine this is probably a very sophisticated operation. It's a fairly basic, haphazard kind of endeavour, isn't it?
It's actually as basic as the very first cables when they went from Valencia to Canada. What they had to use deep in the ocean was a grappling hook to run it along the ocean floor, hope to find it, hope to bring it up, hope to connect the two ends together. Because nowadays, yes, close to shore, you can fix it with a diver or a remotely operated vehicle, which is a robot. But a little bit out from shore, more than 2 kilometers, when it's more than 2 kilometers deep, you're in, well, deep water, as they say.
Yeah.
And you have to use a literally a rope and a grappling hook to find it. And then it's a cutting grapnel that they use, and then they bring it up and they fix it on board a ship way, way out at sea. It's really incredible.
How many ships are going around fixing cables?
There's only 50 of them. And that might sound like there's 50 in the world, but there's 400 cables. And at any time, there's really only 20 that are fully operational. The others are in port or they're being fixed. And so if somebody decided that they wanted to mess with us, a couple of boats out at sea could do some serious damage. And while the book is not really about that, it's more, I was kind of interested in the notion of repair, because as you know, Bren, we're living in fairly shattered times, fairly broken times. And so I thought, okay, well, how do I find some sort of story that's about repair? In the end, even my own notion of repair got broken, because it ends up being a book about repair and sabotage at the same time too. Because, you know, I do think we're aware of all the stuff that's going on around us. Can we actually, make ourselves good in the process of being aware of it? And that's part of the question that the book poses, I suppose.
Yeah, and that notion of connections and broken connections, everything. Like Fennel, the main character, he's a writer and he's reporting, so he's a bit disconnected anyway, the way maybe writers who are just observing things can be. But do you think, is there a broader sense that we're all increasingly disconnected from each other?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned Eliot there earlier, and I do think, a lot of us are like Prufrock right now, you know, the lonely men in shirt sleeves hanging out of windows. And basically, we're trying to figure out, who and what we are. And while we're so, we have this technology at our fingertips, we have become increasingly disconnected, and these little shots of dopamine that go into our brain, we have to question, where they're coming from and why it is that we want them. One of the things about all of this is, who is controlling all of these cables? And it's quite interesting.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, it's Google and Meta and Microsoft and all the big computer companies, and they also they own the cables, and therefore they sort of own the information that's going on within them. And so, in many ways, for me, this was a question of a sort of new colonialism, a sort of capitalist colonialism. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything like this, but the fact of the matter is, all of these cables are owned by a very small number of companies that have a vested interest in keeping them alive. They're not owned by states. You know, the Irish state doesn't own the cables that are running around, all of our country. They're owned by companies, and private companies get to fix them. And maybe people can go out and sabotage them at the same time, too.
And it's interesting then you draw that analogy with the colonialism, and like there you do, I think, consciously refer to Conrad's Heart of Darkness in the book. And I think that was Congo, wasn't it? Which was, again, yes. It wasn't the Belgians had a colony in Congo. It was King Leopold's private kind of business going on there. So you're basically suggesting that these large private businesses, and sure, again, the East India Company, that was a private business as well. These large private businesses are colonizing our minds, kind of, without getting too down into conspiracy theories.
Yes, I would. I think that's perfectly put, Brendan. I mean, the thing about it is, over 150 years ago, the person who put down the first cables, his name was Cyrus Fields. His favorite term was faster, faster, faster. Guess who else is saying faster, faster, faster? You know, all the Elon Musks of the world, and you know, it's interesting that story hasn't changed. But I think the more that we bring attention to it, the more that we, you and I, and say the ordinary person sort of questions what's going on. You know, who owns our data, and why do they have access to our minds in certain ways? And is this a new form of colonialism? And can we sort of interrupt it and stop it? And at least, at the very, very least, be aware of it.
Okay. So, fantastic. Colm, you know that your kids and my kids listening to this are thinking, these are two crazy old men. What are they talking about? We're more connected than ever, connected through social media. We're more in touch with our friends. It's a world of connection.
I know they would say that, but they also know that they're going through an epidemic of loneliness and isolation. And even when we're so connected, they are well aware that this loneliness is out there, because there's something unfulfilling about the contact that goes through the technological ways. And when they get together, and I know this because I work in a lot of schools these days, when they get together face to face, there is a magic that happens that is completely different to anything that can happen in your computer or your phone or in TikTok or anywhere else.
That's interesting. So, yeah, I want to ask you about, talk about Narrative 4 in a second. So is it that kind of waterfall of constant information and content that we're all consuming nonstop now, which maybe we mistake for connection, that right. We're not meaningfully processing any of it in a kind of a human way or an empathic way, yeah?
Well, I don't know about you, but I go on the internet and I jump around, and after about half an hour or about 40 minutes, I suddenly realize that I've gone down several different rabbit holes, and none of them had to do with my original excursion. Now, whose fault is this? You know, I can't start blaming Google and Meta and all these things, because part of it is my fault as well. So if I can get aware of this, and if we start telling each other stories about this sort of connection, and we can figure some of the things out, maybe then we can confront it, because, you know, the technology's there. We're not going to ever get rid of it. But is there a certain way that we can use it powerfully so that we can actually truly connect with one another and make it into something that benefits us? There's always a desire to make things better.
Yeah. So then back to Narrative 4, and that is about, I think, the idea of people, young people especially, you're saying, you're going into schools, understanding each other by telling each other their stories face to face. Is that right?
That's right. And it is primarily face to face. This is one of the things that I adore the most. It's as powerful to me as, writing books. And I've been writing books now for for nigh on 40 years. I can't believe I'm even saying that. I just had a big birthday, by the way, and so I'm very aware of that. But I have been telling stories for 40 years. But one of the things that really brings joy and meaning to my life is through Narrative Four. When we bring young people together, primarily face to face, in classrooms or across counties or even across countries, to tell one another stories in the first person. It's a notion of sort of what we call radical empathy. And what happens in the kids' minds is that they say that they have never experienced anything quite like it before, because their story is valued. And the story of the other person whom they're speaking to is even further valued. So they
So
begin to connect.
the person is telling the other person's story, but in the first person, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I get together with you, and you tell me a powerful story, say from your youth, or even from this morning, or yesterday. And then you and I get back in a group, and I say, "Hi, my name is Brendan." And you get in, and you say, "Hi, my name is Colin." And something really magical happens when you're telling somebody else's story. And it gives you, as I said, it gives you value and gives you meaning in the world.
Yeah, so you inhabit their story, literally. Yeah, but then I suppose, look, people are going to argue as well that we're maligning the cables here, but that, like, all this modern communication has democratized things. More people have a
Yes.
voice. We've seen, say, what's happening in Gaza like never before, from all the people in there having the technology to show us stuff. We saw inside Ukraine, continue to see. We see what war is in a way that we never did before, courtesy of technology.
You're absolutely right. And the thing about all of this is that you can have a truth, and then you can have a truth on the opposite side of it. And then the scientist Niels Bohr
Okay.
actually talked about this. And you can have a truth on the opposite side, which is also a very deep truth. And I think the problem is that we're not prepared to hold two opposing truths in the palms of our hands at the same time, because it can't. And this is what's wrong, say, with politics, and this is what's wrong with the way, you see the world going, and all this stuff that's unfolding awfully in front of our eyes, is that the contradictions are gone, the messiness is gone. And one of the beauties of life is the ability to be more than one story, to be more than one thing. And I do think that the technology is incredibly powerful. And yes, we know what's going on in Gaza now. And yes, we know what's going on in Ukraine, and it's awful. And we can feel it. We can empathetically feel it. At the same time, we need to be able to get in touch with ourselves in order to be able to, expand the world in different ways and change the things that are going on, not only within ourselves, but then hopefully in Gaza and other places, by being concerned and being properly engaged.
Okay, yeah, no, that's intense stuff, but you're communicating it very well, and it is very thought-provoking. So on all that notion of holding two truths at one time and polarization and everything, how are you finding life in America now? Is it hard if you're not a supporter of Donald Trump?
Talking about holding two truths at the one time. Look, it's very tough to be here right now, but it's very tough to be anywhere, and I have to realize that that's what's happening, say, in the Oval Office is often also happening in the Doyle, I am very, very, very concerned about what is unfolding in front of our eyes, not just for now, but primarily for, say, 2 years down the road, when people realize that they've been sold a bill of goods that was not the same as what they have been told, when they realize that the carnival barker, is leaving town, and the medicine bottles were not medicine, but they were, a bad form of
Yeah.
moonshine.
Yeah. You
What
could use
happens
the
then?
monorail salesman in The Simpsons. Remember that episode? It would be a metaphor for it. But listen, the thing is, it's interesting you say about when people realise this 2 years down the line? And I've heard some people are encouraging the Democrats at the moment that the best thing to do here is play dead and let this collapse under its own contradictions. And you know, people have been wondering, where are the Democrats? Indeed, the last few days, people asking, where's Obama? Where Clinton? Where are all these guys? Is the resistance kind of muted this time?
It's really muted. You know, I've been shocked that there have been, say, you know, no protests down in Union Square. I've been shocked when I go to university campuses and people just feel, you know, that it's all very quiescent, and it's almost as if people are just stunned. We've had a double punch to the back of the brain, and are just getting up, sort of concussed, trying to figure out where we are, what's going to happen. And I think that's a little bit dangerous, because when people do finally get to their feet, they might be just staggering around a little while. But I think there will be a lot of anger when all of this comes to the fore. And some people have to double down on the fact that they were fooled. And that's scary in itself. You know, very few people admit.
So people not wanting to admit any buyer's remorse here.
I think that might be a problem. But I'm hopeful. I'm a terrible optimist.
Come here. There's a great documentary on Apple TV at the moment. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a six-parter about Vietnam.
And no, they have
incredible footage from Vietnam, and then all the footage that we've seen down the years from America as well. But to see how fired up young people were then, does it feel as if maybe young men in particularly in America, are they kind of opting out a bit, as back to the cables maybe and sitting in front of screens?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, one of the trendy words amongst young people, and I was just talking to high schoolers actually in Charleston, South Carolina, about this, and in particular, young men, they're being nonch, and what that means is they're being nonchalant, and it's cool to be nonchalant. It's cool not to care about Gaza. It's cool not to care about Ukraine. It's cool not to care about what's happening in the White House, you know, on their watch. I think that's because they're really scared. I think that's because what the deep stuff behind that is, they're very fearful about what's going on.
Yeah, because remember, Russ, you're kind of roughly Gen X as well, and irony was the big thing for us when we were younger, and everything was ironic and the world was in kind of inverted commas. And you look back and it was actually because we were scared. You're so right. Yeah, so you retreat into the safety of kind of an ironic distance from things.
That's right, and you retreat into the safety also of the machines, you know, and the video games and the things that are an alternative reality, you know. I think, you know, this sounds a little bit high and mighty, but Rumi said, you know, yesterday I was clever and I wanted to change the world. Today I am wise and I want to change myself. But I think that's a powerful notion. But we have to change ourselves first. And that happens in schools. That absolutely happens in schools.
Okay, yeah. And then you'd wonder, like, how much critical thinking or, you know, a suitable education we're giving people in schools. Like, has it caught up with the world as it is, you know?
Well, wouldn't if an alien came down from outer space, I think they would be, like, astounded that we don't teach our young people in the way that we have available, or that there are different forms of education 5 miles down the road from one another, or that we would deny certain young people a form of education and access. And I think that's what the world's information is about. And it goes back again to Twist and to what happens. All the information that's carried in our tubes, if we used it properly, we could be, you know, we could be in such a better place, but we're not using it properly. So part of it is our own fault, and part of it is that we're actually being manipulated by, you know, these bigger companies that know what lies in an algorithm, and they're going to get you with their algorithm, and that's quite scary.
Okay, let's end on a lighter note. Happy birthday, by the way, belated. So, you, as you alluded to there, you turned 60 this week, I think. How did that feel?
Actually, it felt great. I decided, you know, like a while ago, I decided if it's got to be 60, it's got to be 60. At least it's not 65 or 70 yet. And I had a great time, actually. There was a lot of people, had a good party and got a lot of people together. And my old friend, Philippe Petit, the tightrope walker, whom I wrote about.
Oh, yeah.
Let the Great World Spin, came along and he was talking about the fact that he's now 73 and he feels that he could walk any rope in the world and he doesn't really care about age whatsoever. He says he's going to keep tight rope all his life. That was a good inspiration for me.
Are you doing something with Sting around that as well?
We are, yeah. I'm doing, and we're working on a musical together. But listen, you never hold your breath on things like that. Hopefully, it'll come out. But Sting has written a song called "Let the Great World Spin," and we're doing a number of songs together. So we'll see.
Sting's turned into an interesting character, hasn't he?
He's a great man. I just say that you know he's still the son of a milkman, you know, from Newcastle, still writing the songs that he wants to write. Yeah, he's famous, and yes, he has wealth and all sorts of things, but his real wealth comes in you know, the decency of his vision and his personality. It's really interesting to watch.
So before we leave it all, so as you turn 60 now, do you feel connected?
Do I feel connected? I actually do. I still like people. Yeah. I still like the world. I'm not going to run away from it. I'm not going to run away. You know, I love being back home in Ireland, of course. And it would seem like the logical place for the world to be right now. I do think Ireland's doing better than virtually anywhere else. But I'm not going to run away from here. I am connected in all sorts of ways. And I still believe, as I said earlier, you know, I might be a pessimist of reality, but I'm also an optimist of what can actually happen in the real world as too.
Okay, I really enjoyed Twist, Colm, and it's published by Random Penguin Random House. It's available from Tuesday, March 11th. Colm McCann, thank you so much. Great to talk to you again.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.